Hey everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. Every month at ASAP Now, we feature something for you, either from the magazine or special podcast-only content, and we have a fun one for you this month. We cover, of course, the practice of emergency medicine and workforce changes, and we often foray into the ancillary parts of emergency medicine, and this month we are talking about talking. Because every one of us has to present and give a talk at some point in residency. And whether you hate it or love it, it does become a part of our careers. Some of us may go on to present beyond just our residency at conferences, in media, or in our academic titles as attendings. But truth be told, we are all talking, even if not just to the patient, and presenting and selling a story and a treatment plan. So it really is something we all have to do, but it's not always something we get a ton of training on. So this month, we have a special guest with a really magical story with some tips and tricks for how he thinks of this. Check it out. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, and thanks again for joining me. I have with us this month Dr. Salil Bhandari, who is the Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at UT Health Houston and also the 2023 winner of the ASAP Rookie Speaker of the Year. Now, Salil, thank you so much for joining us because you've got a really an interesting story.
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me. I'm really excited to be here and hopefully share some tips and pearls that everyone can take home with them that they can utilize whenever they're giving a talk or giving something, an instruction to one of their colleagues.
So I was telling you before we started filming that you are the first magician that we have ever had on the podcast, and definitely the first cruise line magician. And this is actually relevant to what we're talking about today. So tell me about that.
Well, I hope this is a first magician. There are not many of us out there in the world, magician physicians. So it's a rare breed, but there are a few of us out there. But yeah, I'll tell you a little bit kind of about my story and how that kind of fits into giving presentations, giving talks. But basically, when I was a child, I was introduced pretty much at an early age to the field of magic at that time. My uncle actually, I still remember, came to me with a banana, and he like laid it down in front of me when I was a child, and he made these hand motions above the banana, these imaginary hand motions like he was slicing the banana from up top, but without even touching it. He then proceeded to peel the banana, and when he peeled the banana, it was completely sliced from top to bottom. And I remember I was so flabbergasted as a child, like I just did not understand that how he did it. And eventually he told me the secret. Now I'm going to reveal the secret right now, which is against the code of magicians, but for entertainment purposes, he had basically taken a small little pin, punctured the banana in various spots and sliced the banana. You just couldn't see those little pinholes. But obviously as a child, it was absolutely incredible. And I was just so captivated by how something like that happened. And he showed it to me later on. And I just began showing this trick to so many of my friends. And from there, I just truly began to learn the art of magic. I was lucky that my mother and father were quite supportive. I think they felt at the time it was just kind of like a fun side hobby that I was kind of developing, and they were very supportive. They took me to see various shows around Houston. I saw David Copperfield, I remember, when I was young, and I just was so flabbergasted with everything that he was doing, and I just didn't understand. And I would go to my parents, and I'm like, how are they doing that? How is he flying on stage, or how is he cutting himself in half, or how is he making one object appear here and vanish? And they just didn't have an answer, and they kept saying that, oh, it's all an illusion. And I just didn't understand what that meant. And so I was a very curious kid growing up, and so as a result, I wanted to find the answer, right? That's kind of similar how we are in medicine too. I just wanted to understand like how the body works. And for me, magic was very much the same way. I just wanted to understand what was the answer behind these tricks. And so I would go to the library and I would just find whatever books I could on magic, and I would just start to learn these small tricks and understand the basic principles. And once I started to really learn the basic principles, and I found some really good books, and then I found one of like the core textbooks of magic almost, and I really learned the principles, that's when I think my abilities kind of as a magician kind of got much better. And I began to really learn sleight of hand. I began to learn audience control, audience management, and all of those aspects that come with a performance. And I started to build, I'd say high school and college, it got even, I got more interested in it. And eventually after college, I told my parents that, hey, I think I want to be a magician for some period of time to see how it goes. And of course, my parents were immigrant parents who had come to this country hoping for a better future for their children. And here they are having their child say they want to be a magician. And in their brain, they're probably thinking, what the heck is my child doing? We thought it was just a small little hobby. Now you're saying this, you want to do this as a career? Hold up a second. But but thankfully they allowed me for 1 year. My father said, I'll give you 1 year, see what you can do with it. And after that, we'll decide. But I still had an interest in medicine also, because my father was a physician. So I had kind of had that as a backup in case it didn't work out. But during that year, I ended up working on Carnival Cruise Lines. I'd done some stuff with David Blaine in New York City. We would go to like some of the hospitals and do magic for some of the kids over there. But I think my main stint was with Carnival Cruise Lines. And I would just go back and forth to the Bahamas and Alaska, and I would entertain audiences on cruise ships. And I didn't realize it at the time, but magic was kind of my way of healing people to a certain degree before I even had a license as a physician to do so. Like a lot of people would say that, oh, they were so worried about their life, about this or that, but this was a brief escape for them. It allowed them to escape and not think about that. Or I remember I would have friends in college come to me and be like, dude, I have a headache. Can you show me something just to like take my mind off of it? Or I'm so in a way, I enjoyed that healing part of it without realizing what I was really doing at the time was truly healing in just like a very different way, and also entertaining as well. And then I'd say after I did that for about 6 to 8 months, I enjoyed it a lot, without a doubt. There was no part of me that didn't enjoy it, but I felt like I was limited in kind of what I could do with it. And My hobby, when your hobby becomes a profession, sometimes it loses that like luster, that wonder with it. And I think when I was forced to kind of do it every single day and do a show every single day, it kind of lost that that wonder. And I really enjoyed actually having it as a hobby only, and not actually as a profession. And so that's when I kind of decided that, you know what, I want to keep this as a hobby and I don't want to do it as a profession. My parents were, of course, very thankful, and I wanted to go to medical school instead. And so in medical school, I'd say during my residency, or after medical school and during my residency, that's when I started to educate to my peers. And I didn't realize it, but I think a lot of those skills that I learned as a magician all of a sudden came flooding back, whether it was how to craft a story to get people engaged, or how to control or how to manage an audience. If someone asks a question, or what do you do if something messes up? How do you manage that? And I think a lot of those principles that I learned that were so applicable, and it really shot my speaking career up, I think, as an educator. And I was just so thankful having had that experience as a magician for so many years, and I think really contributed to all of the things that I learned and what I even teach now to my residents about how to speak, how to deliver a presentation, and how to truly captivate an audience.
So there's so much here, because you talk about, you know, how to distract, how to captivate an audience, and we do that not just in speaking, but also in just seeing patients, right? I mean, pediatric patients are a great example of this. Like, you have to really captivate them, distract them to do what you need to do. And so you came up with these great seven steps on speaking that you now use in academic emergency medicine. And I would love for you to walk us through that because, again, my takeaway from this was that these are great pearls for doing a talk, for sure. But I thought that they were actually great pearls for just patient encounters because in a way you're on a stage, like you're, you know, healing, as you said, you're distracting, you're captivating. Like I loved where you came from with that concept. So go ahead and take it away.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you're totally right. A lot of this is applicable to so many things that we do. And any of these principles you can take for even the bedside and how we educate our patients, right? We're always distracted. So anything to keep people engaged in this modern society is so important. It's not just a bonus. It's vital. It's essential to any sort of education, educating patients as well as educating our colleagues. So it's a seven-step process, but I can assure you that this is a process that I have used over and over again, not just for myself, but I have taught hundreds of residents this process. And I have tested it various times, and it can lead to very good quality presentations if you can follow it. And so we'll kind of go through it one step at a time. And so step one is basically preparing and researching your topic. And I call it kind of prepare deeply, not just like broadly. And I think before you design any sort of single slide, so many people, as soon as they start getting a topic, then they open a PowerPoint and they start messing with the fonts, or they start messing with slides. Everyone always goes to Wingdings and sees, I just want to see what this looks like because it's just fun. We just start going up this alley of PowerPoint just start to design the slides. And I'd say completely make sure you do not do that. Don't even open PowerPoint. That's not even on the radar right now. But truly just immerse yourself in the subject itself. Read anything that you can get your hands on the subject, whether it is blog posts, whether it's book chapters, whether it's up to date, whether it's listening to podcasts on the subject. Become a master of kind of the material first before even figuring out exactly what you want to talk about. Once you kind of understand the material, then you can kind of truly find the aspect of it that you really enjoy or that you think is most interesting and kind of focus your talk on that. So number one, though, is just build a foundational understanding about the topic and kind of become a master and an authority and just research fully your topic. So that's a relatively simple one. But step number two is essentially one of the most important steps, I'd say, out of anything else. And it's the step that I think a lot of people skip and where a lot of presentations kind of go astray is because they don't do step number two. And step number two is to identify 3 to 4 take-home points that you want to emphasize. So I almost think of it as the analogy of, would you ever get into a car and not really know what your destination is? I think most of us figure out what our destination is before we get into a vehicle and then start driving, right? We don't just start driving and then figure out, oh, I think I want to go here, right? So same thing with a presentation also is you have to know, what is my destination with this, right? What are those 3 to 4 take-home points that I want my audience to remember? What are those specific things? And I'm going to build a talk now around those 3 to 4 take-home points. And instead of trying to build a talk around the entire breadth of a subject, pick a smaller aspect of the subject and focus on that. It's better always to go speak deeply about a narrow area as opposed to speaking broadly about a larger topic, right? Instead of maybe talking about the entire breadth of mesenteric ischemia, maybe doing a talk that focuses specifically just on the imaging or just on lab abnormalities or just on the diagnosis of it is maybe a better talk because that's maybe where the interesting part of it is or the physical exam aspect of it or anything along those lines that allows you to have a more narrow scope is always better. So find those 3 to 4 take-home points, and they should be clear, concise, and make sure those take-home points kind of get repeated throughout your talk. So that's step number two, is identifying those 3 to 4 take-home points.
And I love these two so far because, like, they're so great for emergency medicine ADHD. Like, 3 to 4 points, I'm like, awesome, tell me what to do. And the prepare deeply, not broadly, like, yep, pick a small thing that you can be really deep on, be ready for the Q&A, right? Like, I judge speakers on the Q&A usually. And so I love these so far. Tell us about step three.
Yeah, so step three is basically building a strong outline for your talk. Now, I always tell residents to first kind of build a basic outline, and then you kind of do a more detailed outline. Your basic outline, I think once you have your 3 to 4 take-home points, now you can kind of structure, how do I want this talk to go? Like, maybe I want to do a case study, and then I want to introduce a case. And then based on that case, I'll ask this question. Then I'll talk a little bit about the indications and give some evidence behind that. And then I'll talk about maybe imaging or treatment for something. And then I'll give some of the evidence, and then we'll go from there. So kind of structuring how you want that talk to go in a basic outline. And then the bulk of your work is going to be a detailed outline. And I tell people to truly put on your detailed outline as if you were, imagine as if you were giving a speech. Like, all the information that's on there is truly everything that you're going to say in your talk, from all the evidence that you're presenting, all the evidence that you're showing, every case, your introduction, your examples, your little side notes, everything imagined should be truly on that detailed outline. And that's where the bulk of your work will come in. A lot of people spend so much time on slides when it's quite the opposite. The bulk of your time should be spent on building a good quality, detailed outline that goes from one point and builds to the next point and builds to the next point, that all build towards those final 3 to 4 take-home points. So that would be step three, is creating a strong outline.
Great. Tell me about step four, because I think that's the meat and potatoes of your talk. And now you kind of get into some more, I think I call it style points of talking.
So step four is where I think a lot of my background in magic probably truly helped. And step four is actually scripting your introduction and conclusion. And there's not a lot when I speak that I actually write out in script, like what the specific words I'm going to say. I'd like to go off of my outline. And if I know your outline well, you can kind of give a good talk without having to memorize what you're going to say specifically. But my introduction and my conclusion are the only two areas where I will actually write them out, because those are the most impactful moments, is how you capture your audience in the beginning and how you leave them in the end with what message they're going to remember. And because they're so important, I will actually write out my words, like in a paragraph. And I might not say it exactly in those words, but I want to at least have that prepped. And a lot of people, I think, don't realize that. They ask me afterwards how I created an environment in which people were captivated. And I tell them very clearly that, yeah, I script out my introduction and conclusion. It's not cheating. It's preparing, right? That is, I know exactly what I'm going to say for that. And when you do an introduction, I think this is, tell me if you've seen this happen, right? Most people go up there and they say, hey, today, my name is so-and-so. Today, I'm going to talk to you about this. And they give their topic and just kind of say what they're talking about, right? So whenever you start a talk, instead of saying, my name is so-and-so and I'm going to talk about this, you just stand in front of your audience and you begin with a story of some kind, right? Or a clinical case or a joke or something along those lines that captivates them. And for example, I had a resident who was doing a talk on occult traumatic injuries. Like, what are some of those traumatic injuries that we sometimes don't realize or don't see? And I asked him afterwards when we were discussing it, I was like, huh, what is the reason that you wanted to give this talk? And he told me that he was actually a sniper in the military. And as we went through his talk, we started to realize that, oh, he had spent his life kind of looking for these small, tiny, little objects while he was a sniper in the military. And naturally, I think he was inclined to find small injuries in the ER as well that maybe people were missing. That was just his natural inclination. And so we said, let's tell a story about that. So he started a story with his life in the military and what he did as a sniper in some of those stories. And then afterwards, he tied it in and said, and this is why today I want to talk to you about occult traumatic injuries, right? So it's he truly gave a story first of why he wanted to talk to us, and then almost gave his formalized introduction of my name is so-and-so, and this is why I want to talk to you today about occult traumatic injuries in the ER. So I think that's a really good way to do your introduction is people love stories. People always love to hear stories. So starting it with some sort of a story is extremely helpful, or even a provocative question that you can ask people. Mm-hmm. I do a talk on overcoming imposter syndrome. And the first line that I say is, why is it that so many people, so many high achieving people in this world still struggle with feelings of self-doubt, right? So that is the first line that is said, as opposed to, hi, my name is, because that's a line that most people can probably identify with to a certain degree, and their attention is immediately kind of raptured into that question, because they can probably identify with some aspect of it. So either a question that provokes people, or a clinical case, or a story, or even a joke, or even just simply why you wanted to kind of do this topic, are way more interesting methods of getting your audience interested in hooking them up front, as opposed to the traditional, hi, my name is, and this is what I'm going to talk to you about. And then when it comes to the conclusion, I'd say something similar. I always encourage my residents to end on something that is philosophical, right? We all end with, okay, anybody have any questions? No, okay. And it's a very anticlimactic ending, right? So I actually ask my questions. I give that time for questions. And then after the questions are done is when I actually do my proper conclusion. And you don't have to do it that way. That's just one method. But at least at the end, have some call to action that you want to encourage people to do. I give a talk on resuscitative hysterotomies or pregnant the resuscitation of the pregnant trauma patient. And in the end of the talk, I talk about seatbelt safety and how so many pregnant patients are never taught how to properly wear a seatbelt. And so make sure that you encourage people to do that, like some sort of call to action, or pay attention a little bit more closely to your pregnant patients who are in the ER compared to the other patients, just because they can decompensate much quicker potentially in various areas. So having some call to action or tying it to the beginning is a wonderful way to kind of end your talk.
Yeah, and I love this because this applies not only to talks, but also writing. So for anyone that does do any writing, whether it's academic or just otherwise, just like storytelling writing, I think your point here is really important, that the introduction is what makes you memorable, the conclusion is what makes you memorable and needs a call to action. So I love this one. So Salil, you're like on a roll. Go ahead and tell us the next step.
All righty, sure. So the step number five is kind of where people always want to know, like in terms of designing your slides. And I can assure you that if you do a good quality outline, a good introduction, good conclusion, the slides are so much easier and they kind of come naturally and they take way less time. Step number five is truly some tips on slide design themselves. And there's so many of these tips that I can give, and we'll kind of just focus on some that I feel like are extremely important and quite common that come up. The first is the main concept of the slides. I see a lot of, we've all seen presentations in which the entire presentation is basically written out on the slides. And so the question becomes, if I can get everything I need to know from your presentation just by reading your slides, what is the purpose, right? Like, why do we need you? And so philosophically, you need to think about that part of it, that really, what is my role here? And so your slides are simply to accompany you. You are the main subject. You are the main speaker, and your slides are only there to, and truly think of it as if you are giving a speech and you have no slides. But whenever you feel like you need a visual aid, a slide comes in. But at the end of the day, you're truly kind of giving a talk or giving a speech at the end. And that's how I like to think about it. So your slides are there to support you. You are not there supporting your slides as the main focus of attention. So, and then when it comes to slide design, I'd say there's a lot of small things that I'd like to mention. So I'll focus on a few other things that I think come up constantly. So in order to make slides less busy, of course, we want to take any sort of text and try to translate it to images. The audiences always prefer seeing images as opposed to text. So whenever you can do that, do that. Another trick that I like to tell people is, instead of putting a bunch of information on one slide, you spread it out over multiple slides. We used to have this old adage of 1 minute per slide was kind of this traditional way to think about PowerPoint slides. And I think a better way to think about it is not 1 minute per slide, but one idea per slide, right? That is it. If you are having multiple ideas, you need to be putting them on separate slides. There's no limit on the number of slides you have. So might as well spread information out. So I think even for like a 30-minute talk, sometimes I have maybe 70 or 80 slides. Because maybe each slide I'm spending maybe 20, 30 seconds on, and then moving on to the next one. So one other aspect that I think that comes up frequently is having a lot of text on slides. And so we already talked about one method is spreading information over multiple slides. But if you end up having to put a lot of information on one slide, at let's say there are 4 to 5 lines of text, one of the other tricks that I use is simply just to use the appear animation, right? Have things come up one at a time, as opposed to showing up all at once. I mean, you and I are both ADD. We all are ADD to a certain degree in emergency medicine. Everyone has some degree. So if you put up a slide and there's maybe a picture on the lower right corner, there's 5 lines of text on the left, and there's another image or maybe a GIF image on like the top right, and you are speaking, your audience does not know where to look. Naturally, they may look at the image on the side. Maybe they're looking at the last line of text on your slide while you're still speaking about the first. So this is truly where direction comes in, right? That's where I learned as a magician, you have to know where your audience's attention is at all times. So that's why I use only one animation in my slides, and that is the appear animation. That's it. There's no spinning. There's no other stuff, fancy stuff. It's just one animation of one thing's appearing, and that's it. On PowerPoint has it. I'm sure Keynote has it. Various other things have it, but that's the only one that I use. So as I talk about something, I want that line to show up. Then I talk about the next photo or the next thing. Then I click my button, and then that line shows up. So having things show up one at a time is one of the most critical steps to maintaining engagement in your audience, making sure they are following you the entire time and they're not lost, and keeping them with you throughout the entire process. So I think those are two huge things just on its own, those two things of splitting information over multiple slides and also using the appear animation can drastically improve your presentations just by using those two methods alone.
Yeah, because it sounds like you're really using your slides to drive the audience on the journey you want them to, which is an interesting model, because I think most people use slides as a bit of a roadmap. And so they point to it as they go and there's a bunch of ideas on it. So I love this idea that you have of garnering their attention where you want it by matching it to the cadence of your slides, which is a really interesting thing that I'm sure came from your time as a magician. So I haven't heard that one before.
If I'm doing some sneaky move with my right hand, I can only do that if I am sure that they are not looking at my left hand. So that same concept is truly applicable here, is just guiding them by knowing exactly where they're attending. It cannot be anywhere else because there's only one thing on this slide, or there's only one set of text that has just come up next. So it truly is game changing for any sort of presentation delivery. Step number 6 is one of the most important steps, which is rehearse like it's showtime. I think never in my 10 years as a magician would I ever perform a trick for an audience immediately after learning it without any sort of practice. And I see this happen all the time in medicine, where I feel like people do their presentation, but they don't do a full actual run through of it. Maybe they've run through it in their head, but they haven't actually stood up and mimicked like they were actually delivering the presentation. And I think more than anything else, this step of rehearsal is what truly elevates my presentations. There's a huge difference when I rehearse a presentation ahead of time and when I've kind of winged it and just kind of gone off the cuff. It's a much more polished version whenever I have taken that time to actually practice. And one of the tricks that I love when it comes to practicing is actually filming yourself. And when you film yourself, I want you to watch it back in a few different ways. The first time when you watch yourself back, just listen to the audio. Don't look at yourself, and just listen to how you speak. And you'll catch a lot of small things like, oh, maybe I'm saying ums or ahs a lot, or but truly watch it just with the audio only. And then for a second time, watch it just the video only with the audio cut off, and just focus on your body movements and maybe where you're moving across the stage and how you're doing things. And you'll get a lot of information and about that. Then the third time, watch it back kind of full speed from beginning to end with the entire thing. But truly practicing it can build your reps to give you that confidence, especially if you're someone who doesn't feel confident in front of an audience. I mean, that can truly elevate you to another level, is the amount of practice that you have, and really get those nerves out. And next, it also gives you an idea of your timing, right? I know in my presentations when I am about 14 minutes in, I know I'm at the 18-minute mark because I've practiced them. And it's also respectful to the next person who's giving a presentation to make sure that you finish on time. And so truly rehearsal is one of the most important steps also to really getting your presentation tighter and getting it to where a level where you are confident and comfortable and you can speak comfortably in front of an audience as well. So step number 7 is basically the delivery of the presentation, right? And I want you to deliver it like you mean it. And one of the things that I challenge people to do is to get out from behind that podium. I mean, every lecture hall will always have some sort of a podium where everyone stands. But if you take some of the greatest talks of all time almost, or if you see some of the great talks online, I like to watch TED Talks a lot, and I think they're fantastic speakers on there. And you'll never see a podium on those stages, right? You'll see someone out there in front of an audience and walking around that stage, looking at people, interacting with them. And that podium is such a barrier to audience engagement. And it completely goes away as soon as you stand in front of an audience, and people will pay attention much quicker. I mean, sometimes even in my residence hall, in our residency lecture weeks, I will go and like walk up and down the aisles a little bit in the beginning and just truly be in front of the residents the entire time as I'm giving a talk. And that changes the game. You can't not pay attention when someone is literally just a few feet away from you or talking directly to you. But it's very easy to fall asleep when someone's behind a podium and just talking. So that's what I like to do also, is get out there in front of your audience and instead of hiding behind that podium. And The other thing that I learned from my time as a magician was, I mean, there are various times I've been doing stage shows and something terrible happened, and I've had where my entire table fell and it was very obvious and all my stuff went everywhere. And you have those mistakes and flubs that happen. And sometimes there are small mistakes that that I had. And as a magician, the principle always is you never really call attention to your mistake unless it's something very obviously terrible that everyone clearly noticed, like my table falling over. It's almost odd to not mention something when something like that happens. But I think same thing when you're giving a presentation too. If there's some small error that happens, just don't acknowledge, don't necessarily focus on it and say, oh, I'm sorry about this, or make some, just keep on going, just keep moving. And there are many people in the audience who may not have even noticed it. Maybe you noticed it, but many people won't. If it's a big mistake, yes, then of course make some comment about it. But a small one, just keep moving. And I can guarantee you so many people probably would not have even noticed that that happened. I think it truly is about just that presentation aspect of it. And I promise you that if you practice your presentation well, you can truly be comfortable in front of an audience. I know that's scary, but that podium is like this safety net that it's almost like this teddy bear that we hold on to. But getting out there is scary, but you'll have way better quality presentations as soon as you step out in front of the audience and actually interact with
them. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you think back to, you know, your first patient encounters, kind of the same thing, right? We were clutching the door or the computer or whatever it was. And, you know, as you rehearse and have more patients and get used to taking a H&P or what have you, you get better and better. So there's so many analogies to just the care that we do beyond just speaking that you've covered. I've absolutely loved the 7 steps here. I think they're so great for anyone getting started or already doing emergency medicine talks or just talks in general. I would love to hear, what is the single biggest game changer that you've had while lecturing an EM, if you were to give someone advice that's just trying to get started?
I'd say it's the single biggest one that I was taught and that I was told was record your presentation and send it to someone who you think is a great speaker and have them give you feedback. I mean, there's nothing like having a full recording and having someone who's done this before look at your talk and give you that feedback. And that's where you can start to truly make changes, is in that recording. There's nothing else like it. And I've given my recording to various people, Dr. Swaminathan of Anand Swaminathan, who many people probably know as well, was my mentor in doing these talks. And so I would record my presentations and send them to him, and he would give me very detailed feedback of, hey, you're walking too much on stage over here. Hey, this take-home point was not very clear. Be more specific in your take-home points. And I learned a lot of my stuff from that. And it takes a little bit extra step to have someone record it. But usually if you're giving a big talk for the first time, even having someone in the audience record it. I've had my wife record something if she was present over there that I was giving a talk at. And being able to send that to someone is just vital and pivotal. So I'd say that's the step number 6, but truly is one of the most important steps that will elevate your game to the next level.
I love it. Dr. Bhandari, this has been a great talk. I think there's a lot of takeaways for all of us. Those that do talks, those that don't. So I want to, again, thank you for taking the time to go through this with us.
No, thank you so much for having me. And hopefully there's something that everyone could take home, even if it's just talking with your patients, like you're saying. It has so much applicability to what we do in emergency medicine as a whole. And I hope something of this, something here, at least you can take home with you.
I hope you had a fun time listening to this one and got some great takeaways with Salil's 7 steps on how to give your next talk, but really on just how to present, even if just to your next patient. Now, as Salil and I were getting ready for this podcast, he wrote something that I thought was really wonderful that I'd love to share. And he said, quote, "A great presentation isn't just about delivering facts. It's about crafting an experience. And like any great illusion, it's built on structure, rehearsal, and intention. The audience may not remember every detail of your slides, but they'll remember how you made them feel. So step on that stage, virtual or in person, not just as a clinician, but as a storyteller, a guide, and maybe even a little bit of a magician. And what I loved about what Salil said is the how you made them feel part, because that one is so true to me for patients also. They remember what you said, for the most part, but what sticks with them is how you made them feel important, validated, and sometimes educated or better. Now, we only sadly have about 30 minutes each month for the podcast, but there is tons more in the magazine.
Be sure to check out Advocacy with North Carolina State Representative and ASEP member Dr. Timothy Reeder. And of course, there's tons of clinical content. There is the new clinical policy on carbon monoxide poisoning, ROGAM updates in first trimester bleeding with Dr. Lauren Westifer, desmopressin in head bleeds on patients on antiplatelets, and simplifying something not so simple, which is interlipid administration in the ED, all in the magazine for you this month.